Nearly 50 days until Election Day and Campaign 2020 is hitting the crucial home stretch here in Iowa. We dive into the issues and candidates driving the headlines on this Reporters Roundtable edition of Iowa Press.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa PBS Foundation, the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
Iowa PBS is supported in part by Wells Fargo. Fuel Iowa is a voice and a resource for Iowa's fuel industry. Our members offer a diverse range of products, including fuel, grocery, and convenience items. They help keep Iowans on the move in rural and urban communities. Together, we fuel Iowa.
I'm a dad.
I am a mom.
I'm a kid.
I'm a kid at heart.
I'm a banker.
I'm an Iowa banker.
No matter who you are, there is an Iowa banker who is ready to help you get where you want to go. Iowa Bankers, allowing you to discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks.
For decades, Iowa Press has brought you politicians and newsmakers from across Iowa and beyond. Celebrating nearly 50 years of broadcast excellence on statewide Iowa PBS. This is the Friday, September 11 edition of Iowa Press. Here is David Yepsen.
It seems nearly every week in 2020 has been dominated by a litany of news events and issues. The home stretch of Campaign 2020 is no exception. Here in Iowa, while the coronavirus pandemic is still impacting everything from school attendance to church services, candidates are running a different kind of campaign. The usual rallies and handshakes have been replaced by a virtual town halls and a distant wave from at least 6 feet away. To get an inside look at the current issues, we've gathered a reporters' roundtable. Journalists joining us are Aaron Murphy, Des Moines Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprises, Caroline Cummings, political reporter for Sinclair Broadcast Group, and Kay Henderson is news director at Radio Iowa. Well, welcome, everybody. Lots to cover today, and I want to hear from all of you. Caroline, I'll start with you. The pandemic. What's the political fallout of the pandemic on Iowa politics?
Well, I think it remains to be seen, of course, at least in the general election context. We've seen some polling showing really divided on party lines in terms of is the President and Republicans handling the coronavirus response well, or are they not? In terms of Kim Reynolds, who's at the helm of the state's response, of course, she's not up for re-election this year. She's got two more years on this term. So I think for the strong feelings on both sides about her response, I think that will obviously, you know, we'll see how that really tees up in the next few years. And if people remember this, and I'm sure they will, because it's obviously a colossal moment.
Aaron Murphy, what do you think the political effect is on the pandemic of the pandemic?
Yeah, I did just want to say that, and I'm probably just too naive and shouldn't be in this spot I find myself in. But I can't help but be a little sad that we even have to have this discussion. It has become a political thing. I would have liked to have think that maybe a once-a-century pandemic would be something that we could try and tackle collectively. But like everything else in our world these days, the political sides have retreated to their respective corners in a lot of ways. I think Carolyn makes a good point. When you look at something like this, I think the biggest political impact is going to be felt at the executive level. So the president is going to be judged on this heavily in his race. And here in Iowa specifically, I think we see a bigger impact in a couple years when Kim Reynolds is up for re-election. And I'm sure any number of the actions she's taken will be relitigated in that race.
Okay, how do you see this?
Waving at you from, I think, 8 feet away, David.
Right.
The one thing that occurs to me is that the mood among the electorate is dour, and it's for a variety of reasons. The pandemic, of course, the derecho, and drought for a lot of farmers who didn't get hurt by the derecho and see their crops flattened. They're having reduced yields because of the weather situation. You also have this ethanol issue sort of hanging around and depressing corn prices in particular. So people are not happy for a variety of reasons. We are hearing that people are more depressed than ever, and people have just gone into their respective caves. Mm-hmm. You've got Republicans on one side and Democrats on other, and there aren't a lot of independent swing voters this time around, in my estimation.
Caroline, expand a little bit on your observations about Governor Reynolds. I mean, as has been said, this may not have an impact on her until 2 years from now, if she runs for re-election. But, boy, she is having to make some unpopular decisions.
And I think this line that she said yesterday during her news conference Thursday, we're taping this on Friday, of course, she said that, well, essentially, no matter what I do, I'm not going to please everybody. And I think that's really true because Republicans have praised her efforts more or less. Democrats have condemned them. And that's teed up into court battles. You've got she was sued over her closure of bars in six counties. She was sued by her in-person learning requirements, her in-person learning requirements. Of course, the courts decided both in her favor that she had the authority to close those bars down and that she rightfully interpreted the law governing schools during a pandemic. So I think that she is facing criticism, to be sure. But then, of course, there's Republicans who think she's approaching this right. And I think that the most recent polling we've seen on this issue is that there was one poll in August said that she had 28% approval rating, among the lowest in the nation. Then there was yet another poll the same week that said her overall approval rating was 58%. And there was some more deeper divisions on issues like schools and mask mandates. So I guess, you know, those polls, of course, are just snapshots, but I think it kind of adds this dimension to that this is not just cut and dry. People maybe agree with her on some things, they disagree on others, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. That's what will be most interesting to me as time passes, and again, especially if Governor Reynolds runs for election again, and these issues are relitigated. You know, we all know how Democrats feel about Kim Reynolds handling the pandemic, and we all know how Republicans feel about her handling, because we hear that. But there's a lot of people out there who vote but don't get caught up in the day-to-day political grind. But the pandemic is very real to them, so they'll have strong opinions on that, too.
But Kay, isn't she in an inordinately bad position here? I mean, everybody who's mad about schools and the chaotic schedule, if somebody's not happy, I can see every school principal just saying, you go talk to the governor about it. People with sports,
right.
Bar owners. Right. I mean, it's not very good for a politician to have every bar and restaurant owner in the state bad-mouthing you. What do you make of that?
Well, and there's also not much separation in the minds of voters between the executive of the United States of America and the executive of the state of Iowa. So she's sort of, marching through this pandemic with Trump, and people see that among the Democrats, and they react to it viscerally. And Republicans, who otherwise might be a little trepidatious about the use of some of the executive powers that we've seen, they are party line behind the governor. So she's benefiting a little bit from the fact that Republicans feel as if, some of them feel as if they need to defend her. She's also benefiting from the fact that depending on where you go in Iowa, there are certainly different views about the pandemic. Mm-hmm. If you go to rural Iowa where they don't have a lot of people living there and they don't have a lot of people who have contracted the virus, their view of the pandemic is a lot different than it is in places like Iowa City and Ames, those liberal bastions of the state of Iowa.
Yeah. And it's also true, that old adage, you can't beat somebody with nobody in politics. Mm-hmm. So it isn't going to be just her against her job approval rating. There's going to be a Democrat against her, and that person will come with pluses and minuses as well. Aaron, talk about the impact on sports. We have our priorities in Iowa. You know, we got to have our high school football. We certainly got to have a Hawks game and a Cyclones. What's the impact of all this on sports?
Well, and it's interesting because there's different levels to this. So at the high school level, the athletics, the fall sports now, football, volleyball, cross country, et cetera, have been tied into the debate over whether schools should be back in person, in that the governor has said if a school district wants to move online, that means they can't play sports during that period either. And that's kind of created a whole new kind of pressure because as we've seen and we've heard from people who react when sports are canceled, they're not happy about it. They want their sports. They want it to be attempted even during this pandemic. So that's gotten twisted into the whole school debate. And then at the college level, right here in Iowa, we have the Big 12 and Iowa State playing, the Big 10 and Iowa not, which has become a political football as well. Apologies for that one.
Is there any political ramification to any of this, or this is just something inside the campuses or in schools about football and athletics? Any political fallout you can think of?
There's great uproar in the campus towns of Iowa City and Ames about this. But if you look at the lineup of state legislators who represent those two cities, they're Democrats. Not a lot of Republicans representing those areas, and so it sort of falls along partisan lines.
Caroline, another big issue being talked about a lot is absentee ballots. A lot of Iowans, maybe most Iowans for the first time, will be casting an absentee ballot. Is this going to be chaotic?
Well, there's some questions about that because there's these three lawsuits, Woodbury, Lynn, and Johnson counties. The auditors were sued over pre-filled absentee ballot request forms. Two of those were already decided by a judge voiding those pre-filled forms. And we have another decision pending that could come down as soon as today. And so people are confused about, well, if I already sent my pre-filled ballot form in and now that doesn't count towards getting a ballot, it's incumbent on the auditors to let them know that it doesn't count. And then they're also going to be inundated with multiple absentee ballot request forms, which is totally normal and fine if you can send multiple ballot request forms back and only get one ballot in return. But I think all of these decisions are weighing heavily on voters, also because maybe they don't understand that a court decision in Polk County, or excuse me, Johnson County or Lynn County or Woodbury County doesn't have bearing on their other counties, but it's just going to add this, you know, all these news headlines coming at them. I'm sure it's causing some confusion.
Yeah, I think the short answer there is there's evidence that already is chaos. Carolyn's absolutely right about everything she said. The good news is at the end of the day here, we're still only talking about absentee ballot request forms, and I want to make that clear for the viewers. Right. We're not talking about the ballots themselves. So once they eventually get their ballot, cast it, and file it, that you know, as long as you're a person that wants greater turnout, that's a good thing and should be okay at that point. But in the meantime, yeah, there's a lot of chaos with the different ways that auditors are handling this.
And looking ahead, David, to November 3rd, Iowa has a law that's more favorable to counting those ballots than many other states, like New York, which had horrible problems with its primary this summer. The auditors can open the envelope the day before. You know, we had Polk County Auditor Jamie Fitzgerald on the program a couple of weeks ago. He has special equipment to slit open those envelopes because he's going to get tens of thousands of envelopes carrying those ballots. And then they can count them. They can run them through the machine as soon as the polls open on the 2nd, and then announce the results, tabulate the results when the polls close.
Yeah, and I think it's important. There's a lot of talk nationally. The president's talking about fraud. You have election officials in Iowa who say, yeah, it's different. This might be a little bit confusing, but there's no evidence of fraud.
And you can also
corruption.
Track your ballot. You
That's
can
right.
go online and see where your ballot is.
And they're also saying we should know the outcomes in Iowa
right.
on election night, unlike some other states that may not be true. Aaron, let's go to talk about voter registrations. Republicans, we talk about polls, but the voter registrations, Republicans have a narrow edge statewide.
Yeah, and this is interesting because coming out of the caucuses, they didn't. The Democrats had overtaken them, benefiting from the caucuses and the great interest there was with a very competitive Democratic race and not as much on the Republican side with an incumbent Republican president. So Democrats had taken the statewide lead, and since then Republicans have regained that lead and have actually expanded on it. When you break it down, what's interesting by congressional district, they have a large statewide lead, but it's all built in one congressional district. Democrats have more registered voters in the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd districts. Republicans' advantage is built entirely in the 4th district. So it's good news for them statewide. So Joni Ernst likes to see that. But it does present some challenges still for Republicans at the congressional level, especially in those competitive 1st, 2nd, and 3rd district races.
You know, Republicans are spending a lot of time and money and phone calls, so almost like with a screwdriver or chisel, going in there digging out supporters. Aaron, does that tell you that their turnout operation is better than the Democrats?
You know, I think that's a fair question right now, and they've kind of got a unity project working right now from the Trump campaign on down through the local races. They're kind of all working as one big Republican team. It's not the Trump campaign and the Ernst campaign and on down the online. And you know, we'll find that out for sure, and it's showing up in the registered voter numbers at least. But the other thing to remember is these races, especially those congressional races, often come down to the no party voters, which in some cases are high than Republicans or the Democrats, and which way they're swinging.
The other thing that we can't forget is that before the June primary, the Secretary of State sent an absentee ballot request form to every active voter, and independent voters or no party voters picked a side. So if you look at how registration has changed from before that happened to after it happened, and we had record turnout among Democrats and Republicans in the June 2nd primary, that can also be traced to that mailing that Paul Pate sent out.
Okay, one new ingredient in the Iowa equation this year, it's felon voting. Mm-hmm. Paul Pate was on this show, estimated that 35,000 potential voters have been re-enfranchised as a result of Governor Reynolds' executive order. What's the political effect?
It's unknown. We have various groups that are trying to help folks figure out how to register to vote if they are among that 35,000 group that the Secretary of State mentioned. You know, if half of them vote, will that benefit Democrats? Will it be a wash? It's hard to know because, you know, has anyone polled this group of people to know? And also, will they participate? That's the other thing that we don't know. If you look at some other states, there's some evidence that, you know, that there's not a lot of participation when people gain this right. It's sort of unknown.
Well, you know, one of the things, some Republicans were worried about this because they see a lot of those inmates are minority voters. Generally, those voters tend to vote more Democratic. But I've talked to some Republicans who say, you know, a lot of those, there are a lot of white inmates in Iowa. They're blue collar. They're not as well educated. And that profile is a Republican in this electorate.
The other thing you have to remember is that to be a voter, voters have a propensity to vote. So if you voted when you were 18 and you're 65, you'll be more likely to have voted throughout the course of your adulthood.
Let's go around the table. Caroline, I'll start with you. We'll talk about the race for president. I'd like to quickly hear from each one of you about your thoughts about how the race for president in Iowa is going.
Well, of course, the pandemic, like all campaigns, has upended a presidential campaign in this state. I think that people are seeing Iowa, or they saw Iowa as maybe a year or two ago as, well, it's a Republican stronghold. You know, the president is not poised to lose it. But then the numbers, again, polling numbers, albeit snapshots in time, are shifting towards it really is becoming more or less of a toss-up. And I think that that perhaps that's why we've seen Vice President Pence coming through Iowa for events to try to make sure that they keep the Iowa base. And, you know, we've also got Kanye West on the ballot, so that's a whole other thing in there.
What's the effect of that? Kanye West? Is he going to siphon off enough votes? He's a rap music singer, African American. Mm-hmm. Is he going to take enough votes away from Democrats to tip the state to Trump?
Well, that's the GOP. Some few in the GOP are making that play, right? Is that he might siphon off some people, but there's polling to show that only 2% of black voters, of course, that's national numbers, say they support Kanye West. So I think that that's not necessarily true, that just because he's a black rapper that black voters are going to vote for him.
Well, it is true that it's Republican operatives that are behind this, but
yeah.
Aaron?
Yeah, and to expand on that real quickly, my sense is that there's not as much interest in a third party vote this year as there was 4 years ago. I think this is a much more even split. You're either for President Trump or you're going to go for Joe Biden. Right. I don't think, unlike 4 years ago when there's a lot of protest votes, I don't like either candidate, so I'm going to vote for Jill Stein or whoever it might have been. I don't sense there's as much appetite for
There were 1.3% people who voted for president in Iowa in 2016 who wrote somebody else's name in. We're not going to see that this time around.
Talk about the Senate race, Kay. How do you see that unfolding here in this?
Early in the year, we saw that this was a competitive race. It is ranked among the competitive Senate races in the country. Lots of outside money being spent on this race. What I find most interesting is that, to sort of digress here, but you have two women running against one another in the Senate. You have two women running against one another in the first and in the second. You have a woman and a man running against one another in the third district. There's going to be parity in the Iowa congressional delegation, and there may actually be a majority of women win on election night.
Aaron, how do you see the Senate race?
50 and 50 in 2020,
yeah,
group
exactly.
is smiling somewhere. The polling has showed a close race, and that's very believable given what we kind of knew coming into this. Kay talked about the high stakes. Iowa could help decide which party controls the Senate nationally. Joni Ernst has been kind of attacking Teresa Greenfield based on her business record, and they kind of accuse her of quote-unquote hiding in her basement, not being out in the public a lot and doing public events. Conversely, Ernst has kind of come under fire lately for some comments she made kind of feeding into a town hall questioner's question and kind of conspiracy theory type take on COVID deaths. So we're seeing the punches thrown. The polls haven't showed a lot of movement yet. I think we still have a really close race.
Kay hinted at how expensive this race is, and I feel like perhaps that's heightened, of course, because it's close, but also maybe the dynamics of a race that's being conducted in a pandemic. You could argue that these races, while so colossally important, the presidential election and, you know, maybe the deciding factor on flipping the United States Senate from Republican to Democrat, that it's not taking up the oxygen that it perhaps otherwise would because of these other conversing issues that we're facing. We've got the pandemic, you've got record unemployment, you've got, you know, race relations. I mean, there's so many other things that almost seems like it supersedes the, you know, day-by-day horse race of what, you know, Teresa Greenfield saying, what Joni Ernst is saying, and vice versa. And then also, just to the point about the expenses, I mean, you can't turn on the television or watch a YouTube video without seeing an ad for this race. But so they're putting a lot of money, clearly, into advertising to reach people during the pandemic.
It's wallpapered is the term for it, and I'm not sure any of that stuff is moving any numbers. It's just so much media there.
And that might also be because of all these other pressing issues that are capturing headlines. People aren't paying as close attention.
And then the other thing is that, you know, the Ernst people are sort of employing the anti-Romney strategy that Obama did. Let's attack the business record. And also they're doing what President Trump is doing against Biden, as you mentioned, you know, accusing her of staying in the basement. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Greenfield campaign has not been explicitly tying Ernst with Trump.
Right.
Mm. Because she needs Trump voters from 2016 to vote for her.
Let's quickly move through the congressional races. We've just got a few minutes left. Caroline? What's your assessment of the first district race? Abby Finkenauer versus Ashley Hinson.
Like we've mentioned, campaigns obviously upended by a pandemic, but I think what's unique about the first district is they are really the one that's hit the hardest by the derecho. So that derecho response in terms of what Finkenauer has done in Congress, what Hinson would do, you know, those are issues that are maybe more at the forefront for that district than perhaps other districts. They were at this very table litigating that during a debate recently. So I think that that's an interesting dynamic.
Second district.
Open seat race, been held by a Democrat, Dave Loebsack, for a long time, but it's a district that Trump carried in 2016, so Republicans feel they have a good shot there. Polling has kind of been a little bit all over the place, but mostly showing a close race with Rita Hart in the lead. Some more recent ones have shown Marionette Miller Meeks, the Republican leading.
Yeah.
So I think a competitive race there.
Okay.
One of Iowa's, in the third congressional district, David, one of Iowa's first ever congresswomen, Cindy Axne, a Democrat from West Des Moines, rematch against former Republican Congressman David Young. The interesting thing about this is this rematch is really not at the top of the ticket for a lot of people in discussions. They're more focused on the other two races that have been referenced before.
Aaron, real quickly, did J.D. Scholten choose poorly when he decided to run for Congress as opposed to running for the U.S. Senate?
It'd be interesting to get his honest take on that. Now, he made that decision before the primary, so when Randy Feenstra knocked off longtime incumbent Steve King, who's been in hot water for all kinds of things over years, that completely changed the dynamics of that race and made it so much harder for the Democrat in that race. So it's a fair question. Might J.D. have been better off as a Senate candidate?
K. Okay, real quickly, the battle for the Iowa House. Democrats have a shot, do you think?
They hope that they have a shot. They're investing a lot of money in it. Fred Hubble, who ran for Democrat, who was the Democratic candidate for governor last time around, investing in that strategy. Republicans are raising money and hope to go after a few swing seats that are occupied by Democrats. It could be a nail biter for people on election night.
Democrats are getting national help money on that,
right,
too.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, they would need to break the Republican trifecta. We're out of time. Thanks, all of you. And we'll be back next week to dive into economic issues confronting Iowans. With sectors of the American economy still reeling 6 months into a global pandemic, we'll sit down with Midwestern economists Chad Hart of Iowa State University and Ernie Goss of Creighton University. That's next week at our regular times, 7:30 Friday night and noon Sunday. For all of us here at Iowa PBS, I'm David Yepsen, and thanks for joining us today.
Funding for Iowa Press was provided by Friends, the Iowa PBS Foundation, the Associated General Contractors of Iowa, the public's partner in building Iowa's highway, bridge, and municipal utility infrastructure.
Iowa PBS is supported in part by Wells Fargo. Fuel Iowa is a voice and a resource for Iowa's fuel industry. Our members offer a diverse range of products, including fuel, grocery, and convenience items. They help keep Iowans on the move in rural and urban communities. Together, we fuel Iowa.
I'm a dad.
I am a mom.
I'm a kid.
I'm a kid at heart.
I'm a banker.
I'm an Iowa banker.
No matter who you are, there is an Iowa banker who is ready to help you get where you want to go. Iowa Bankers, allowing you to discover the genuine difference of Iowa banks.